Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, folks, where Sudhana Dumay makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He was here, I think, 3 years ago. He's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington and writes a column for the Wall Street Journal. He has written a book on the rise of radical Islam in Indonesia, which was first published in Australia and subsequently being published in America and in Europe, entitled My Friend the Fanatic. And he's a widely respected commentator in the United States on a number of topics, including India. And tonight, Mr. Dumay is going to speak for us on the topic of Narendra Modi at the crossroads. Will the Indian Prime Minister fulfil his potential? But of course, when we come to question time, there are the other issues relating to national security, terrorism, and I'm sure our speaker would be happy to address those issues. But for tonight, let's start and welcome.
Thank you very much, Gerard. It's a pleasure to be back at the Sydney Institute. And I also wanted to thank my friends from AJAC for bringing me back to Sydney. I was last here 3 years ago. And at that time, you could say that India was in a very different position. So when I spoke here in November 2012, the Indian economy was in a funk. Growth rates had fallen to less than 5%, about half of their peak from a few years earlier. The Manmohan Singh government was being pummeled by corruption scandals, and the world was beginning to ask if the so-called India story, the idea of the world's largest democracy's inevitable rise, had been oversold. And at that time I asked a question, which was whether India's messy politics was capable of throwing up solutions to the country's complex problems. And I certainly saw the glass at that moment as half empty rather than half full. But even as I was giving that talk over here in November 2012, dramatic events were afoot in India. And a month after that, in the western state of Gujarat, a provincial politician named Narendra Modi won his third term as chief minister of Gujarat and used that as a launching pad to become prime minister of India last year. So the next 15 months, he powered his way to one of the most unlikely but also one of the most historic mandates in modern Indian politics, became prime minister of India last year in May. Now, I'm just going to sort of I'll assess Modi's economic and foreign policies and sort of tell you where what that means and where he's headed. But before that, I just want to give you a little bit of a sense of how important that election last year was. This was India's first single party victory since 1984. So we had come to believe that Indian politics was going to permanently be marked by coalitions. Instead, the BJP alone won a single party majority. First time since 1984, any party had done that. It's the first time ever the BJP had done that. It's the first time that the BJP had beaten the Congress Party, which has been India's traditional ruling party, in terms of vote share. So, for instance, when the BJP came to power earlier in the late 1990s, it had managed to win more seats, but it still hadn't been able to beat Congress in terms of vote share. As Australians, you're sort of familiar with the strange happenings of parliamentary democracy. I don't have to explain this to you the way I have to in America. it also, the election last year also marked the lowest ever tally for the Congress party. It got fewer than half of its previous low. So what this has done is it has thrown up Narendra Modi, who I would argue is the most dominant Indian politician in a generation. The world is still getting to know him, and so we'll spend a little time looking at his policies and see what he stands for. Now, Modi comes from a humble background. He himself sold tea at a railway station, so this is quite dramatically different from the Nehru-Gandhi family, which has been in politics for about 100 years, but has been ruling India almost non-stop since 1947, when Jawaharlal Nehru became the first prime minister. So very, very dramatically different family background. He's a non-dynast in a system that is increasingly dominated by powerful political families. He belongs to a so-called backward caste in the upper caste-dominated BJP. He's the first Indian leader to ride his success at the state level to national office. This is something quite common in places like the United States. It doesn't really happen in India, where you had provincial politicians and you had national politicians. And he's the first Indian leader to claim power based largely on the promise of development rather than on overt appeals to caste or religion or sweeping promises of handouts. He's also, quite remarkably for an Indian politician, overtly business-friendly, and during his campaign, he emphasized growth over redistribution. So where does Modi stand today? We have this historical mandate, and you have this quite remarkable character who comes out, breaks the mold, really, in many important ways in Indian politics. Now, I'll get into detail, but let me just so in a nutshell, if I had to summarize how Modi has done since being elected in May last year, I'd say he's been surprisingly good on foreign policy, and he's been surprisingly weak on economic policy. And if you'd asked me to predict what sort of trajectory this government would take 15 months ago, I would have probably guessed the opposite. First, let's look at foreign policy, which has really been his strength. Over the past 15 months, Modi has achieved one of the most dramatic image makeovers on the global stage. For a long time, he had been viewed largely through the prism of the 2002 Hindu-Muslim riots in Gujarat. Now he commands attention as a charismatic leader of a nation on the upswing. As President Barack Obama wrote in Time magazine, Modi's life story reflects the dynamism and potential of India's rise. And I'd say that if you want to sort of summarize how he has seen, that's as apt a summary as any. World leaders from Obama to Japan's Shinzo Abe to Xi Jinping to Tony Abbott have all rolled out the red carpet for Mr. Modi. And his thumping election win last year and continued popularity make him the G20 group's version of the popular new kid in school. Who wouldn't want a selfie with Modi shared with over 14.4 million followers on Twitter and another 29 million on Facebook? In the English-speaking Western democracies, the large and successful Indian diaspora's obvious regard for the Prime Minister adds an extra layer of gloss to his appeal. Not many world leaders can draw 20,000 cheering fans to New York's Madison Square Garden or 15,000 at Sydney's All Phones Arena. Modi's reputation as a strong leader has also helped him, particularly after the policy paralysis we saw in the last few years of the Manmohan Singh administration. U.S. officials, for instance, speak favorably about India's newly energized bureaucracy and contrast it with its earlier listlessness. The government has also made bold decisions. It has set a new path, for instance, in terms of relations with Israel, where for the first time India abstained of the UN Human Rights Council on a vote against Israel. Modi has also announced that he will become the first sitting Indian Prime Minister to visit Israel. That will most likely happen next year. He's also reached out quite dramatically to the United States. This year, Barack Obama became the first ever U.S. president invited to preside over India's annual Republic Day parade as a chief guest. And in a sense, that broke, even though the U.S. and India have been growing closer to each other for many years, the invitation to Barack Obama seemed to break a taboo that went back all the way to the Cold War. Similarly, he has reached out to his neighbors, particularly Bangladesh, where he visited Bangladesh and inked a historic border accord which fixed a problem going back all the way to partition in 1947. So foreign policy has been successful. If I had to sort of point out, for those are his big foreign policy hits, if I had to point to misses, I'd say that he struggled with Pakistan policy. He started out trying to draw new red lines. So what he wanted to do was send a message that he would be willing to trade with Pakistan, but that he would expect Pakistan to take a firmer line in terms of terrorism and promoting terrorism, and also in terms of the nature of the Pakistani engagement with separatist leaders in Jammu and Kashmir. He started out with that. In the end, it sort of ended up becoming a little bit confused. So his Pakistan policy, I would argue, is looking more and more like his predecessors. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing would depend on what you thought of his predecessor's Pakistan policy. But let's turn to economic policy, which is in many ways the more interesting and the more important thing. Because, as I mentioned earlier, this is a person who was elected to fix the economy. This is really you see this transformation of Modi from a figure who emerges from the right wing of the Hindu Nationalist Party, viewed with great trepidation by many Indian educated urban elites, becoming effectively the most powerful and the most popular leader in the country, based on the idea that he has transformed himself into Mr. Development. He's been very focused in the last several years as Chief Minister of Gujarat on fixing the economy. Gujarat had one of the lowest unemployment rates. It had one of the most successful records of attracting foreign direct investment. He was seen as someone who slashed through red tape and, in his own words, believed in something which he called in maximum governance, minimum government. So which is sort of as close as you could get to in Indian politics with the legacy of Nehru and Fabian socialism and so on to a small government conviction politician. Now, it's not as though the Modi government has had no achievements over the past 15 months. Growth this year is set to surpass China's. India will grow at 7.5% according to the IMF. Foreign direct investment in this first year rose 27% to $31 billion. Foreign institutional investment in the stock market rose more than 400% to $45 billion, which is the most since liberalization began in 1991. Modi has scrapped the Planning Commission, a symbol of Nehruvian socialism, and he's replaced it with a think tank led by a respected Columbia University economist. Recently, Foxconn, the Taiwanese manufacturer most famous for making iPhones, has announced that it's going to invest $5 billion in the Western Indian state of Maharashtra to set up a manufacturing hub. And also, the Modi government has cleaned up natural resource allocation by moving from a system which was driven by government discretion to auctions, which makes it much more transparent, and they hope to use that to dodge some of the corruption scandals that had plagued the previous government. So that's all in the sort of in terms of what they've managed to do. But I would say that the misses probably outweigh the hits. And to be fair, this is partly, I mean, when I go to meet people in the ministry, in government ministries, and I talk to his ministers, they accuse me of being unfair. And they say that it's because expectations are high. And that's certainly true. Modi should be benchmarked against high expectations because he has a historic mandate. But if you benchmark him against those high expectations, I would say that on the economic front, he has been a bit of a disappointment. Last week, we saw the monsoon session of Parliament washed out. And effectively, the two biggest reforms that this government has tried to pursue have both been stymied in Parliament. The first was a land bill where the previous government had made it extremely difficult to acquire land for infrastructure. And effectively, as a joke went, that it was easier to buy land on Mars than in India. So Modi came in, Mr. Business Friendly, and the whole idea was that he was going to come in and fix this. But in the end, he was hit by a lot of political opposition, seems to have lost stomach, and turned around and decided to go effectively with the old Congress Party's bill, which was passed in 2013, rather than challenge it. And the second has been a very ambitious move, which has been in the works for a long time, going back to the previous government, to stitch India together into a single common market. It's called the GST, or Goods and Services Tax. And the idea is to replace many, many small levies with one single tax so that India effectively becomes a single market of 1.2 billion people instead of being divided into many, many smaller state markets. That has faced opposition by the ruling Congress, by the previously ruling Congress Party in Parliament, and they've effectively stalled Parliament, and the bill has not passed. So the two big reforms that we would have expected that he would have pushed through by now have not happened. But beyond that, what's to me somewhat worrying is that he is not showing signs of being a conviction politician when it comes to economic issues. This is a person who seems to be more concerned with better administration than with reform. So if the Indian economy, if this is a kitchen, this is someone who thinks that you can make India work better by unclogging the pipes. This is not someone who says that we need these pipes to be in different places, or perhaps we don't need that many pipe inspectors, at least in terms of what he has done, though his rhetoric of maximum governance and minimum government would have suggested otherwise. That rhetoric has really not been followed through in any meaningful way so far in terms of making that reality. The other disappointment on the economic reform front has been the government's approach toward taxation. Modi came to power promising an end to what he called tax terrorism, which essentially means, you know, the Indian tax bureaucrats have far too much authority, and they often exercise that authority in a whimsical way. In fact, on the taxation front, the government continues to pretty much pursue similar policies, and in some ways the Modi government has in fact been worse than the previous government. For instance, they put in place something called a new black money law to go after illegal funds held by Indians overseas. But again, this is something that is extremely draconian. They're giving tax inspectors the authority to arrest people. It seems that the kind of thing that is more likely to drive away business and drive away investors rather than creating a more hospitable climate for investment. So those are some of the worries about on the economic front. On the whole, I would say that at this point, you know, they have India, the terms are 5 years. At this point, 15 months into a five-year term, it is far too early to write this government off. Modi is by far the most popular politician in India even today. There was a poll released just the other day which said that 4 out of 5 Indians think he's doing a good job as prime minister. Those 4 out of 5 need to say, don't write opinion, don't write op-eds. but they are. So he's lost the editorial pages, not that he ever had most of them, but he's lost what he did have. He still has a lot of support on the street. The opposition is extremely weak. The main opposition leader, Rahul Gandhi, is seen as feckless and inept, widely seen as feckless and inept, and not a serious challenger, not really up to the task of taking on a grassroots politician like Modi. The BJP and its allies rule states that account for more than half of India's GDP. So if he really wants to do something, he can, and it's difficult to achieve on the national stage. He still has a lot of room to achieve that at the state level because they control many of the most important states, including Maharashtra and Gujarat, in Western India. So there is potential, but I would say that for the first time since his election, some of the sheen is wearing off I am not as optimistic as I was in May 2014, where I thought that the victory of Modi was unambiguously a good thing, and that here was a prime minister who was unquestionably going to turn the economy around and turn India around. The danger for him, of course, is that if he does not reform and if the economy begins to lose steam, he's going to have many, many disappointed people across the country. I covered his campaign last year, and he went from town to town, and he was where he was promising people development. For most people, that means jobs. He cannot create the number of jobs that he needs without vast amounts of inward investment. Just to give you a sense of the scale, India has about 12 million new entrants into the job market each year. That's a million people a month. These are people who overwhelmingly, young people who overwhelmingly supported Modi. They supported Modi regardless of caste, region, language, anything else, because they felt he was the person who was going to deliver. And he will need to deliver that in order to come back in 2019. And I would argue that in terms of foreign policy too, to a large extent, the success of Modi on the global stage, part of it has to do with it, the fact that he's a charismatic figure and he's won a big election victory. But a lot of it is also due to the idea that people felt that here is a person who can help India achieve its potential. There's a lot of goodwill for India, and there was a lot of disappointment with the Manmohan Singh government for really squandering an opportunity. And so people are willing to give Modi a chance as the person who's going to really make India fulfill its the potential that we've all been hearing about for a long time. So what I've been arguing is that if he does not get his economic act together, some of this gloss that we've seen on the global stage will begin to wear off. That hasn't happened yet because there's always a lag, but it will happen. And finally, and this is particularly of interest to me because I'm currently working on a book on Indian conservatism, is that the danger is that he is going to fail to create a right-of-center narrative to challenge the left-of-center narrative that has long dominated Indian politics. And if you go back to the last BJP government of Atal Bihari Vajpayee, which ruled from 1998 to 2004, it was a much weaker government. It didn't have a majority. It ruled in a coalition. But it did several things that created the outline of a center-right narrative. So it privatized companies. It simplified tax forms. It tried to do things that clearly set it apart and that clearly indicated that it had a problem with the economic philosophy that had come before it. I'm not saying that Modi is a Nehruvian socialist. He's not. But he has been timid about doing things that will offend people, with the possible exception of this land law, but on that he's folded. But other than that, he has been very careful about giving the opposition space. And you could argue, and many people in his party do argue, that this is simply smart politics, and Vajpayee's bold economic reforms didn't really help him very much because he was booted out in 2004. But I actually do not think that it is smart politics either. I think that you cannot be someone who is elected as a transformative leader, and you can't be afraid to break a few eggs in order to make an omelette. So with that, I'll close my comments and look forward to your questions.
Many thanks to Sudhana Dumai, and thanks to Anthony Orkin and the Australia-Israel and Jewish Affairs Council, who provided our speaker here tonight. So we come to questions and discussion. We've got lots of time, so just hang on, everybody. We've got plenty of time. So we've got to the top of the hour, if we need to go that long. I mean, you've raised a lot of issues tonight in foreign policy, and they're interesting, but I think you stressed that you thought the economic challenge was the more important one. But if you were in Prime Minister Modi's position, what would your priorities be on the economic agenda? I mean, judged according to what it's possible to do, not what you would like people to do, but what it's possible for the government of India to do and get through the various legislative and executive requirements.
Well, the first thing I would have done was I would have scrapped what is probably the worst law passed by any Indian government since liberalization, which was the so-called retroactive tax passed in 2012. It's extremely unpopular. There is no political constituency for retroactive taxation, so there's no political cost to be paid. And it would have sent a very clear signal to businesses and investors around the world that this government was going to be different. Instead of doing that, Modi and his finance minister, Arun Jaitley, sort of chose a halfway house where they said, well, we're not going to scrap it, but we know we really don't like it, and we promise we won't use it. It's really an awful law, but, well, we're not going to scrap it. So that, I thought, was sort of weak, and that was an easy win, which they didn't take. I would certainly have moved towards privatization. You don't have to privatize every state-owned company, but there are some real stinkers out there. Why is the Indian government making scooters that no one ever rides? Why is it making camera film that no one ever uses in the age of the iPhone? So there are companies that are complete stinkers. And for someone as gifted as Modi, it was an opportunity to say to the people of India that he was going to privatize these companies because they were sucking in government money that could be spent better on the poor. Big missed opportunity. He's been weak on that. And finally, I would have brought in more outside talent. I would have done more to suggest that he understands that the problem isn't simply a question of getting the bureaucrats to work on time and stop playing golf in the middle of the afternoon, which is good, helps, but there's more to it, and that reform has to be structural. And so the part of the problem is the civil service, and he cannot simply rely on the civil service the way he could as a chief minister of the state.
Okay, next question. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I have two questions. One's very quick.
Could you identify yourself? Thanks.
What do you suspect will happen in the forthcoming Bihari elections, given what happened in Delhi, which was a bit of a surprise, I think, after the landslide national election? So that's the quick one.
Well, hang on, let's stop there. This is an unidentified source. So the question is about the Bihari election.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, so one first. You know, there's a sort of cliche. In India, there's always a significant election looming, and the next significant election looming is Bihar. But in this case, it really does matter. Just to go back a little bit in terms of history, Modi won last year in May the national election. He followed that with a string of dramatic state election victories. But then his chariot, so to speak, was stopped in its tracks in Delhi, where he suffered a humiliating defeat in February. If he loses in Bihar, he'll be seen as weakened. Even though he'll still have 3 years left in office, he'll be seen as someone who has been weakened. It'll give the opposition a fillip. It will make his many, many enemies in the media very happy, because they'll feel that he's essentially in for just one term and isn't coming back. So it matters to him tremendously. It'll also ensure that he will not get achieving a majority in the upper house in parliament becomes that much more difficult. I wish I could predict. I'm not in a position to predict what's going to happen in Bihar. What you do have is it's going to be a tough election for Modi. So you have an alliance of various, you know, the Janata Dal, the JDU, and the RJD, these two parties which were sworn enemies, have come together along with the Congress Party, which hasn't counted for much in terms of seats, but still has a vote share of about 10%. So these parties have come together, and if you just look at them in terms of vote share in the last national election, the parties that are arrayed against Modi, it looks very, very difficult to beat them. On the other hand, there are contradictions within that coalition, because these are two sworn enemies who have come together in order to fight Modi, Lalu Prasad Yadav and Nitish Kumar. So I would say it's 50-50. It could go either way. Campaigning hasn't really begun in earnest. We all know that Modi is an extremely effective campaigner and very popular still. So if he pulls off Bihar, it certainly strengthens his hand. But it's not clear to me what that means for economic reform. In an ideal world, he pulls off Bihar. He has that behind him. He says, now is the time to go ahead with reform. But what if instead he wins Bihar and says, well, you know, this cautious approach seems to work. So that's what I'm not sure.
Just by way of background, I mean, we're a federation here. So what are we talking about? We're talking about a state election, right?
We're talking about a very important state. We're talking about a state with about 100 million people.
But he's not the leader of the party in that state, is he? He's the central leader.
Yes. But effectively what he's done, because he has such a larger-than-life personality, is that in the state elections that have followed since he became prime minister, he has fronted the party. And he's going to do that in Bihar also. So it's not as though he's, you know, it's going to be a provincial face versus the provincial leader there. It's going to be Modi as the face of the BJP. And he's going to turn to people and say, you vote for me, and then I will put in place a provincial leader who will govern you well. That's going to be his promise.
Okay, now we'll move on.
I think
on.
She had a second question.
Well, we'll come back to it. Look at all these others here. Okay. Question here. Yeah.
How strong is the Indian banking system?
Not very strong. You know, as
the
you know,
about the Indian banking system, right? Yeah, okay.
So, Indira Gandhi nationalized the banks in 1969, and Indian banking system. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but very high non-performing assets. Part of the problem is that much of the lending is politically directed, and the capacity to bring to redeem loans that have gone bad, that's quite limited. So the banking system is a problem. Again, we have not seen very bold moves. So for instance, one of the things that the government could have done is it could have said, you know, I think there are 30-odd state-owned banks, and it could have said that it would maybe take the five worst and privatize them or consolidate. But instead, what they're trying to do is maintain government control, at least have more than 50%, and hire professional managers. So that seems to be their philosophy. They think that if it's managed better, if the banks are managed at arm's length, they can fix this problem. They don't seem to recognize it as a deep structural problem.
Can we go down the back? Yes? Can we come over here? Yes? Barry, I'm sorry, Barry O'Farrell. Yeah. Is the former Liberal Party Premier in New South Wales?
From the Australian Media Council, can I... Given that I assume in India, like Australia, you need both houses of parliament to get economic reforms through, could Mr. Modi's timidity, as you describe it, have more to do with his hope that next year he will win that house?
Well,
notwithstanding your current assessment as to whether or not he will.
So it's a question of whether Mr. Modi can win the upper house next year.
So he can't win the upper house next year in any case. The math doesn't add up either way. He probably can't win the upper house before. It'll take at least another 2 or 3 years if he does extremely well. So that's not the issue. But in fact, he does have wiggle room to do stuff. So for instance, in the Indian system, that if a bill is a money bill, I don't know if that's the same over here, it does not require approval by the upper house. The upper house cannot block it. And secondly, they do have the option of the so-called nuclear option, which is that they can call a joint session of parliament. And if you look at the combined numbers in the upper and lower house, the BJP and its allies have a comfortable majority. And in fact, that's something that they might do with the goods and services tax. And the other thing about the upper house that's sort of that's interesting is that the BJP is not close to a majority, but there are a lot of smaller regional parties. So that's just a question of parliamentary management. So it's not as though the Congress by itself has the power to block him. If he's able to come up with the right kinds of alliances. So for instance, if there were a vote in the upper house of parliament, the goods and services tax bill probably would pass because he's made alliances with regional parties that support it.
There's a question down there, and then we can...
Our West Australian Premier has been over in India recently, extolling the virtues of his trip. What's your take on it? Is it all on air?
I must say I did not follow his trip, sort of, I'm not able to comment on that.
Sorry. I thought it would have led the news. I'm surprised. No, we can't help out there. Maybe the West Australian. Yes, the question here. Yeah.
Professor Simon, that concerns the university. Could you comment, please, on the relationship with Israel with regard to Balochistan, Iran, and the Pakistani or Sunni bomb?
So there's a question about Israel in relation to Pakistan, the Sunni bomb,
and Balochistan.
And Balochistan.
So let me break that up, because I don't think I think the relationship with Israel is very interesting. I don't think that it is... I'll come to your question, but I don't think that that's what's driving it. So the relationship goes back to, you know, for the longest time, India did not have diplomatic relations with Israel. It only established diplomatic relations with Israel in 1992. Since then, this has been one of the fastest growing Indian relationships, particularly in terms of defense trade, where Israel has become one of India's top defense suppliers. In terms of intelligence sharing, a lot of that is directed towards shared threats of terrorism. And also in terms of just economic trade, it's gone from a few hundred million to, I think, more than $5 billion, some of that driven by high tech. Balochistan is not really something that is, I think, part of the India-Israel relationship. I think what's driving the two countries together more than anything else is a sense that they have, they face similar problems in some ways. In some ways, the problems are very different. Of course, you know, India is a very large country and isn't exactly surrounded by enemies the way Israel is. But there are similarities in terms of the national security threat that's posed by terrorist groups. And India sees groups such as Lashkar-e-Taiba, which are nurtured by Pakistan across the border, very similar to what Israel faces in terms of Hamas and Hezbollah, which are on its border and sponsored by hostile states. So that's one very strong similarity. There's also a great admiration among many Indians, but particularly among BJP supporters and the Prime Minister, for Israel's economic success story and its ability to it, and how it has transformed itself in the space of a few generations from being a country that was not exactly wealthy to becoming a hub of innovation and high technology. And of course, on the intelligence and defense side, there's a sense that Israel has been an extremely loyal friend to India. It has come to India's help, for instance, in 1999 when there was a conflict with Pakistan. So there is a shared... There's a confluence of interests. There is a deepening of the relationship. Israel doesn't have diplomatic relations with Pakistan. I think India does expect Israel to see its views on Pakistan, and I think Israel largely does views India's take on Pakistan sympathetically. Iran has been a bit of a complication, because even though many Indians are sympathetic to the Israeli position on Iran, there's also been the reality that India relies on Iran for transit to Central Asia and Afghanistan, because Pakistan doesn't allow any kind of transit through its territory. And so effectively, India is locked out of Central Asia, it's locked out of Afghanistan, even though these are places with which India has long had deep historical and cultural ties. And that means that, so that's one reason why it's forced to maintain some kind of relationship with Iran. The other, of course, is that India has a fairly large Shia population, and historically most governments have been quite worried about upsetting them. But that said, those are relatively minor issues. If you're talking about the current P5+1 process, my own views and the views that are dominant in India are probably a little bit different. I think the dominant view in India is that this is a good deal. It's good that Iran is being brought in from the cold. Those aren't my views. I believe that it's a mistake. I think that this particular regime is not a regime that should be trusted. And I think by allowing by effectively allowing a revolutionary Islamist regime to step significantly closer to a nuclear bomb, we are potentially creating great instability in a sensitive part of the world.
Okay, so there's a question here, then we'll go back to the second question. Yeah?
Does the present government have any significant and useful policies in education? The reason I ask that is because the Achilles heel, to my mind, of both India and curiously China, is the paucity of standard of education, both primary and secondary. And even at the tertiary level, if you leave aside institutions like IIT, it's in fact, and I can't see how you could possibly develop a modern economy without changing. And it's an interesting contrast with, for instance, South Korea, Japan, and Taiwan, all of whom from an early stage had a very well-developed and universal system of education.
That's a great
education. Yeah.
Education. Yeah, I think that's a very good question, and I think then the point is well taken. I mean, the big difference between India and East Asia is that after independence, India focused on tertiary education. You know, Nehru had this idea that he would create these elite institutions such as the Indian Institutes of Technology, and this technocratic elite would then pull everyone up, else up, whereas the East Asian nations focused more on primary education, educating the masses. Now, off late, I'd say, over the last couple of decades, Indian policymakers have woken up to the folly of that. So there has been they're putting many more resources into primary education than before. Enrollment rates are very high now in Indian schools. So it's about 100%. Literacy rates are rising rapidly. But I would not say that the education policy has been particularly successful. A few years ago, the last Congress Party government put in something called the Right to Education Act, which in many ways has set back already low education standards. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but the number of Indian fifth graders who can read at second grade level has in fact fallen, and similarly with simple mathematical problems. And part of the problem with this Right to Education Act was that it doesn't allow examinations and it doesn't allow students to be held back if they haven't learned. And it looks at education in terms of inputs rather than in terms of outcomes. Do you have a playground, and is your library this big, and so on. And I felt that there was a real opportunity for the BJP government to rethink this and come into it and look at education in terms of outcomes instead of in terms of inputs. But they have not shown that imagination or drive so far.
Yes.
What do you think drives what seems to me quite a lot of sensitivity in the government towards criticism, in the sense of, you know, the crackdowns that they've done that have been widely reported against a lot of NGOs, particularly Greenpeace, stopping activists leaving the country, freezing bank accounts, and all that sort of thing? Where do you think that's coming from?
Suggesting the government's tough on NGOs, and where's that coming from?
I mean, I don't think since when has it been surprising to sort of that, you know, Indians being thin-skinned? But it's not particular to this government, according to me. I mean, you know, some of the stuff like the FCRA laws that were making it very difficult for foreign NGOs to get donations from overseas actually date back to the previous government. It's certainly true that there's been a sort of unnecessary heavy-handedness. You had not only the crackdown on Greenpeace, where they stopped this Greenpeace activist from flying to London, but also the ban on that BBC film on rape in India, India's Daughter. I think that these politicians from the BJP don't come from necessarily from a, you know, tradition that is as open to criticism. That said, I'd say that these are not, it's not something that worries me. So I have this sort of constant debate going on in India, and I disagree with these particular incidents, and I've criticized them in my column and elsewise. I think that it's a stupid thing to do. If you don't like a film, that doesn't matter. Or if you don't like Greenpeace. There are you can have a conversation with them, but this is sort of it's paranoid overreaction. So I don't for a moment support any of these actions. But at the same time, I think that the conclusions that are sometimes drawn from these are absurd. The idea that India is becoming authoritarian, I think that's just nonsensical. All you have to do is turn on a television show or open a newspaper, and all you see is criticism of the government. So though the government may be thin-skinned, it doesn't mean in any way that it successfully escapes criticism.
There's a question on the back there, yes. Yes.
Thanks, Jerry. Some would say that if you try to change the pipes without cleaning them first, you cause a septic situation. So how would you rate Modi's attempt to clean the administration and corruption and the like in the first 15 months and his reform in the next, say, 2.5 years?
That's a great question.
The question about how's he done in cleaning out corruption from Victor?
I think that's a great question. You know, there was. I'm going to address it in a somewhat roundabout way. Now, before Modi's election, there was a big debate about whether he'd be able to run Delhi well, whether he'd be a good prime minister. And essentially, you had two camps. One view was that this person has only ever run Gujarat, which is a significant state, but it's a state of 60 million people. It's not a country of 1.2 billion people. And he ran Gujarat in a way that you can only run a state. The chief minister is basically like a king. Whatever he says is law. He ran it through a few chosen civil servants whom he trusted, and he allowed them to make policy. It was very effective and very efficient. So critics said that, well, this is a guy who only knows how to run things in this way. Obviously, it's not a way that's going to work in Delhi, because Delhi is too large, it's too complex. India is too complex. His supporters, including myself at the time, argued that, you know, the world is full of talented administrators. Bill Clinton ran Arkansas, and then he found that as a talented administrator, he was able to run the United States quite well as well. So you should look for a gift for administration and don't be literal in terms of how looking at a model that someone has followed. I have to say now, and you know, today, it looks like the critics had more going for them than those who were more optimistic. He has, in fact, tried to, in many ways, replicate the Gujarat model. He has a very centralized system. He has a large prime minister's office and so on. You could say that it's still early days, and it is certainly true that there's something to be said for re-energizing the bureaucracy, making sure that people come in on time, making sure that people are afraid, cutting down on corruption. Corruption has been reduced quite dramatically, partly because people are aware that there's someone in charge who frowns upon it. So in that sense, there have certainly been gains. But my own view is that to run India, he's going to have to change his model. He cannot run India the way he ran Gujarat. I'm still cautiously optimistic that he will figure this out, just because it's not possible to do what he's trying to do. But has he figured it out yet? The answer is no.
So there's Duncan.
In July this year, The Economist published a pretty critical piece about public health spending in India, and especially pointing to the continuing level of malnutrition among children as an example of a failure to adequately take account of the public health issues. How would you rate his performance in this area?
The question about malnutrition.
Now, I haven't... So it's hard to gauge the numbers. So what's happened, one of the things that they've done is that they have devolved a lot more funds from the center to the states. So that's one of the recommendation of a finance commission. So what's happened is that the government spending, the central government spending on various parameters, education and health, has come down, but it's partly because the center has a smaller part of the pie. So what I haven't done is looked at how much of that devolved money has gone to the states and what does that mean in terms of the total spending. But to sort of get back to your question, I think that there's a great... These are state subjects. So obviously there are things that a prime minister can do, but effectively these are things that really matter most at the state level. And that's why you see such dramatically different performance levels in India. So if you take a state like Kerala, where, again, you know, the where its human development indicators are very high on all of these parameters, or you take a state like Tamil Nadu, where the midday meal scheme of, you know, free meals for children in school has been very successful, and then you look at places like Uttar Pradesh and Bihar in the north, which are completely shambolic and have indicators that would match sub-Saharan Africa. So, is this something that it's more a state level issue? Has the Modi government paid a lot of attention to it? No, probably could do more.
There's a question there. We're getting close to the end. There's one down here. Yes?
Could you comment on economic competition between China and India and the effect of the recent devaluation of the yuan?
So, in some ways it's a great story, that sort of, you know, the rise of China and India, and both of these are very large countries, the only two countries on the planet with more than a billion people. One is authoritarian, the other is democratic, and so on. But the fact is that China is far, far ahead of India. China is already a dominant global player. China is already, depending on how you count, the first or the second biggest economy in the world. So with India, it's more a question of, will India get there, right? So if you look around the world and you see, well, there are not too many places that have the potential to become a $10 trillion economy. India is one of those, but it's still so far away from that. I think the devaluation of the yuan is going to affect India quite similarly similar to how it will affect many other countries. It'll hit exports because China is already an export powerhouse. But beyond that, I really haven't sort of studied the deeper implications of that.
Question on the back.
Hi there. I'm from India. I've been here for 9 years. I watched Modi's speech 2 years ago on the Independence Day, and one of the biggest criticisms of the speech was the failure of his government to implement the one rank, one pension policy in the Indian Armed Forces. What, in your view, is the reason that the government has not been able to?
So about the Indian Armed Forces and the failure to implement a one-rank, one-pension policy. Yes.
So let me just sort of explain this for people who haven't been following it closely. One-rank, one-pension is essentially a demand by Indian veterans that you should get the same... Anyone who retired at the same rank should get the same pension. So it doesn't... If you, say, retired as a major in 1955 or you retired as a major in 2010... As long as you retired as a major, your pension should be the same. That's what the demand from the veterans is. And it's a long-standing demand, which India's bureaucrats have found many ingenious ways to stymie for a long time. Modi made a very famous election promise in 2013 or maybe early 2014, where he went to a large veterans rally along with a former army chief who then became a minister in his government, and said to them that I promise you that you will get one rank, one pension. And in many ways, veterans and military people are the BJP's natural constituency, right? This is the right of center party. It tends to be strong on defense, tough on the borders, and all the rest of that. He has not implemented it, and I would say that it's still a promise, and again, in his speech 2 days ago, he said that he has accepted it in principle. It's just a question of working out the details. To be fair to the government, this is extremely complex. This is a very large amounts of money involved, but also lots of complex technicalities. I think he will do it. I think it's a failure to not have done it already. Again, it sort of comes back to what has been my criticism running through this is that here's a person who showed a lot of boldness and showed a lot of flair on the campaign trail, has in fact shown a lot of flair in terms of foreign policy. But when it comes to the sort of nitty-gritty of economic policy or on things like implementing one rank, one pension, he seems stymied. He seems sort of unable to cut through the bureaucracy. And so that's how I would characterize it. But I do think that it'll happen, because it would be political suicide for them not to implement that.
Finally, to get from you. Oh, second last.
Yep. Just on that point about the bureaucracy, it seems, unlike here with our Senate, another vote today, it's something the government wanted. He could do things if he wanted to. To what extent is the bureaucracy a problem?
I think the bureaucracy is a large part of the problem here, because the problem is not just the bureaucracy. The problem is that Modi does not see the bureaucracy as a problem. So Modi sees the bureaucracy as his great allies. And in some ways, he is making them work harder and he's running things. But it comes down to a fundamental diagnosis of what is the problem in India. And I would argue the problem is that the bureaucracy acts only in its, or mostly in its own interests. It has no interest in real reform. It is absolutely masterful when it comes to stymieing change. And if you want to change India along the lines that are dramatic, if Modi wants to become India's Deng Xiaoping or Margaret Thatcher, he has to recognize this, right? So coming back to the analogy of the kitchen pipes, he has to recognize that it's just not enough to bring in a plumber and clean the pipes up. And so far there's just, he seems to think that he can make this system work better. He doesn't need a new system.
Finally, from an American perspective, I mean, you sit at the AEI in Washington, we hear a lot about the relationship between the Obama administration and the leadership in Beijing. What about the feelings between the relationship between the Obama administration and the Modi government? I mean, at a personal level, they seem to get on well, but I mean, is the Indian government content with U.S. policies in the region?
Relations are very warm. I'd say that we had two quick visits. You had, it's again one of those things that one would not have predicted, because for the longest time, Modi had been denied an American visa. Because of the 2002 riots. But as soon as he was elected, to Obama's credit, he moved very quickly and greeted him and welcomed him invited him to Washington. Modi visited Washington, and then a few months later, Obama was the chief guest at India's Republic Day. So things are moving again. There's defense cooperation is deepening. There's technology transfer. The commercial dialogue has been revived. They're talking about moving towards a bilateral investment treaty. So the U.S.-India relationship, I'd say, is on an extremely solid footing. They've been much more forward-looking in terms of some of the language on China and the South China Sea, for instance. And so that has been definitely a success story so far.
Many thanks.
Thank you.
Take a seat, everybody.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.